This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, the exit interviews continue. More than 100 MPs have said they're standing down at the next elections. Today we hear from Government Minister Mike Freer, who said when he was standing down, it was because of the threats of violence and abuse that he's received, and because his husband didn't like him going out to work wearing a stab vest. A really open and honest conversation with Mike about his time in politics and what he might do next. Before that, in the columnist Rachel Sylvester and Libby Purvis, watch along as Rishi Sunak lays down a challenge to the House of Lords as he tries to ram through his emergency Rwanda legislation just 5 months after he unveiled it. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. And with everything that's going on in the world, we can at least begin with some good news.
What the book is about is not trying to, you know, reinstate myself as Prime Minister.
Hey! Thank goodness for that. And the exciting news is my copy of Liz Truss's book has arrived. And it's exciting because it's a free one from the publisher, so I haven't had to part with money for it. So I might actually, I might make an appearance on stage tonight. So if you're coming to see me doing pole dance, my stand-up show at the Bloomsbury Theatre, Monday night, Tuesday night this week, then Lyme Regis tonight, then that's it. It's all finished. It's all finished. Yes, so I might, I don't know, maybe I'll use a lettuce as a bookmark, something like that. Might make an appearance. Much excitement on Friday night. I was doing the show in Taunton on Friday night. Mark's been in touch saying, great show on Friday night. He was disappointed I wasn't wearing my burnt orange shacket. Well, no, I had my stage suit on. Much excitement on Friday night, sitting in the dressing room, waiting to go on. 5 minutes before we went on, knock at the door. And I thought they were coming to get me to say 5 minutes before we go. And said, yeah, just to let you know, all the lights have gone off. So we're just trying to sort that out. So I was just fine, you know, just trying to sort the lights out. So we'd wait about 5-10 minutes and then I thought, oh, good, they've sorted the lights out. Yeah, just to let you know, all the sound has stopped working. What about the lights? Yeah, no, the lights aren't working. So we were about 15, 20 minutes late starting. Then, once I got on stage, they were rebooting the lights in real time. So at various points, like a spotlight would appear and just move very slowly across the stage. There were, like, disco lights suddenly came on. One of the tech ops said to me in the interval, if it's any consolation, this is the worst I've ever known. I was like, not really, no. At one point, somebody shouted out of the audience, is Liz Truss doing the lights? But that was
wrong, wrong, wrong.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
Yes, I'm joined, as ever on a Monday, by Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. And we kick off with Rishi Sunak's emergency press conference.
Enough is enough. No more prevarication, no more delay. Parliament would sit there tonight and vote no matter how late it goes. No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
Rishi Sunak there in Downing Street saying that enough is enough. MPs and peers will sit through the night if they need to pass his Safety of Rwanda bill, describing it as an innovative solution that was needed because so many people were making the dangerous journey across the channel. 9 people have died, he said, this year alone. There were a lot of numbers there as well. 25 courts on standby, 150 judges, 500 highly trained individuals, with one airfield on standby, although he wouldn't give the details of where that was. They've booked commercial airline flights, he said, which is interesting because I know there's been an issue with trying to get airlines to take these flights, which he said would take off in 10 to 12 weeks. Well, listen to all of that. Our columnists, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. Libby, a clarity of message and purpose from Rishi Sunak that we don't often hear.
Yes, absolutely. Keep them up all night. It is an elected government, like it or not. But the gloom still hangs over it all. Suella Braverman was on this morning saying that even with this version passed, it wouldn't be enough to deter the boats and we have to pull out of the European Convention on Human Rights. So I don't know. But yes, looking at it just politically, he does sound as if he's gritting his teeth and trying to say something very, very strong and definite.
And he will say, Rachel, that his opponents don't have a better idea. I mean, whether or not this works will only come out of the wash in the coming months, but no one else seems to have a better idea.
I think the key thing is, on that podium at his press conference, he's got the words stop the boats. He hasn't got the words pass the Rwanda bill or get the flights off to Rwanda. So the key question is, does this policy stop the boats? And if you look at the numbers of people they're planning to send to Rwanda, nobody quite knows how many it is, but at one point they were talking about 1,000 people over the first few years, not even, you know, multiple hundreds of people.
I think actually probably lower than that. Matt Dathan has, you know, talked about it being 150 people. Identified as being.
So that is not going to stop the boats because it isn't a proper deterrent. If you think you're already willing to risk your life to come across the channel on this dangerous boat, if you think there's a small chance you might possibly get deported to Rwanda, it's not going to really act as a deterrent. So I think there's a sort of slight danger of missing the wood for the trees in all of this. And actually, what's the purpose of this policy and is it going to achieve that is what really matters.
I mean, I suppose if it does, I mean, 10 to 12 weeks is still quite a long way off. I was just trying to work out how far that actually is. I mean,
it's the middle of the summer,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and because there are, despite him saying that, you know, no court is going to stop this happening, actually, there is a process.
Which we don't know, actually.
There is a process that could take, you know, I think they could be notified this week. There's 8 days and there's another 23 days and so it goes on. Libby, do you think that if a flight takes off, with people on it, for this policy which everyone said would never take off, will he get any credit for that?
I don't know. I suppose he might, but it's all getting so close to the next election. I don't think he will. I mean, as I say, I was listening to Suella Braverman this morning on, I'm sorry to say, another network, and she was sort of pretty dismissive about the whole idea. But when asked, you know, does she think there should be a challenge to him, you know, again, she shrugged it off and said she didn't foresee any such thing and wouldn't happen and so on. I think we're all just hanging on here. But I'm afraid she did have a point that it doesn't feel like quite enough of a deterrent. It would have to be quite massive. You know, the word would have to be getting around all across Europe and across northern France. There's no point in the boats. You always end up on a plane to Rwanda. And that means big numbers. And I don't see the big numbers happening anytime soon.
And actually, the thing that Matt Dathan, the Home Affairs editor of the Times, was saying, that as so many people have come, anyone who goes on the plane, I've just been in what now early July, will be people who arrived a year, maybe 2 years ago, you know, in terms of it's not people who, you know, with record numbers we've seen since the beginning of the year. So it's just a question, yeah, does that act as enough of a deterrent if you're standing on the shoreline in Calais?
And of course, the Conservative right-wingers are standing by ready to turn this into an issue about Rishi Sunak's leadership and whether he's got the guts in their mind to deal with the ECHR, European Court of Human Rights. So is he? That will become the new kind of right-wing totem, if you like, as a test of his credibility.
And having had so many people, Libby, on his own side saying this isn't right, it's not going to work, he's sort of, you know, he's got one hand tied behind his back by his own side.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose he had to say something firm now, you know, just to give any credibility to the whole thing at all. But it's desperate. It's a desperate thing to watch. There is, as Rachel will be telling us, I hope, about the commission in a minute, there is so much else that we and the Home Office should be thinking about.
Yeah, and in fact, we've had loads of messages of people saying, where have they managed to find 25 courts and 150 judges not doing anything?
Exactly. There's a massive courts backlog.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, prisons crisis. You've got the police, you know, absolutely snowed under. It seems like an odd priority.
Well, let's move away from what Rishi Sunak has been saying in the last few minutes. He's saying that multiple flights every month over the summer to Rwanda, he says, all starting in 10 to 12 weeks, which is actually quite a long way off. It takes you well into July. But the point we were just making, Rachel, if Rishi Sunak can find 25 courts, 150 judges, all these people, it would suggest that the criminal justice system is in fine fettle.
Well, exactly. And it definitely isn't. So today we're launching the Times Crime and Justice Commission, which follows on from our Education and Health Commissions. And we're going to be looking at the whole system, all the way through from crime, the causes of crime, shoplifting, knife crime, violence against women and girls, but also the court system, record backlogs, the policing culture and the prisons, and trying to come up with solutions as we did previously.
Now, it's interesting this, because health and education, everyone likes health and education, everyone's interested and, you know, it's a real sort of like, nobody really cares, particularly in prisons. So you start talking about conditions and everyone's like, wow, they've done it, they deserve it. But actually, there's a real, society should care, because if people aren't rehabilitated or whatever, they come out and they reoffend.
Totally. It's a kind of waste of money if you just lock someone up and they then come out and commit more crimes, the cost of a prison place. But I think politicians sort of underestimate the importance of this issue, actually, because I think people are feeling increasingly fragile and, you know, unsafe and nervous. And the confidence in the police is really worryingly low. So we did a poll for the launch of the commission, and it found that more than half of the public say they don't trust the police to solve crimes, which is, after all, their main job. And a third say they have no confidence in the police to maintain law and order. So when you've got a system of policing by consent, that's really dangerous to have that level of lack of trust in the police. And there've been just a succession of scandals. The most recent is over this anti-Semitism campaigner, but also the Sarah Everard murder by a serving police officer, the Carrick case, multiple rapists. There's a real concern about whether the system is fit for purpose, I think.
There's a problem, isn't it, Libby? Because it sort of seems to stretch across everything, from the appalling stories about the behaviour of individual officers, and then the general sense, which has taken hold, which is that if you run a shop and somebody nicks something, they won't come. If you're burgled, no one's going to come. And so the sort of the consent, the public consent that we are policed by, is sort of being eroded, you know, both high-profile cases, but also low-level erosion.
Absolutely, and it's bang right. I'm very pleased indeed about this commission, not just through general benignity towards the Times, you know, but it's obviously spending money and time on this, because it has been important that the whole thing should be looked at from soup to nuts, you know, absolutely, from broken windows in the street, from the handling of the Palestinian marchers, right through to the prison system, right through to the court system, how it all works. It really needs looking at as a whole issue, you know, between the citizens and the law and the police. It needs to be looked at altogether. And if the commission can do something to bring some of these things together, it would be very, very useful indeed, you know, as it has been, you know, with government taking attention of the other commissions. It just, you know, that terrible survey on lack of faith in the police, you know, should really make your jaw drop. But there are so many reasons that confidence is going, you know, ranging from the fact that shoplifting is just not being cracked down on, that it's not being treated seriously enough, you know, right through to the marchers and the anti-Semitic banners not being treated seriously enough. It feels as if somehow society is losing a grip on itself, and that is a very bad feeling to have.
There is also, I think, sometimes the problem that the Met being the biggest force, but also the one in London, which is therefore most closely followed by politicians and the national media, means that that probably even skews the public perception of policing all that. So just on that story that you were talking about, Libby, this Gideon Falter, the anti-Semitism campaigner, who has received an apology after he was threatened with arrest near a pro-Palestinian rally because an officer told him he was openly Jewish. Let's just take a listen, because Rishi Sunak has just been asked if he has confidence in the Met Police Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley.
I share the shock and the anger that many are feeling when they saw the clips over the weekend. And, you know, what I would say about Mark Rowley and the police, they do have a difficult job. Of course, I appreciate that. But what happened was clearly wrong. And it's right that they've apologised for that. And yes, I do have confidence in him, but that's on the basis that he works to rebuild the confidence and trust of not just the Jewish community, but the wider public.
And we've had actually lots of messages in saying that, actually, if you see the full video of the confrontation between the various groups and the officers, it's a tough job. I wouldn't want to be a police officer, try to pick your way through that. It was a stupid turn of phrase, but clearly aimed at trying to avoid an escalation in trouble.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult, isn't it? Particularly with these marches where people have such strong feelings on both sides. But obviously that officer used the wrong phrasing. I'm not sure what purpose it would do to, you know, fire the Met Commissioner, whether that would really help. But the problem is, it's part of this picture of the police, particularly the Metropolitan Police, losing the trust of different groups. So we, in our poll, I was shocked that more than a third of people and almost half of Londoners think the police are institutionally misogynistic. And there's also high levels of distrust, people think they're institutionally racist. So there is this sense of actually, you know, they're losing trust of lots of different kinds of people because they're not seen to be impartial. Almost half of people didn't trust them to solve crimes impartially.
The weird thing is, though, Libby, they seem to be simultaneously in the minds of people both sexist and racist, but also too woke. They're sort of criticised from, I mean, it's possible, I suppose, different people could be, but you know, both, because it's a big organisation. But it's not just the grumble that we can't get a policeman to come when some, you know, if you're burgled. But there's a problem with the culture and the people.
Yes, I mean, they had this ridiculous hate crime law loaded on them by Tony Blair, and that hasn't helped at all. Police should not have been involved at all in that. But I think, what was really alarming on the survey was this sort of sense, and I think it's at... I've forgotten who it was that said it. Yes, Anne Longfield said that carrying knives, for instance, in a city is getting normalised. She said people are fatigued. And I thought that was a very good expression, a sense that we no longer feel we can rely on it. A parallel thing has sort of happened with GPs and the health service, that sense that we all had, you know, if we had anything ill over Christmas, that, oh, my God, there's no help, you know. 111 will take 3 days to ring back, that did in our case, you know, that there's no help from a doctor, that there's no help from the police, that nobody will do anything. And that, you can't have that. You know, we pay taxes and we submit to laws, whether we like them or not, and we go through democratic processes. But people need to feel that sense of security, that the police will be there, they will come. And of course, in some parts of the country, and in some cases, they absolutely do. And there are terrifically good reports of them. But this whole business with the Met and what has happened within the Met and with the failure to crack down, which is a government responsibility as well, on these huge demonstrations week after week, which terrify Jewish people, make them afraid to go on the street. This is bad. A lot of people sort of say, oh, Gideon Falter, you know, they were trying it on. They were doing it on purpose. They were walking around in kippahs in order to do this. Well, I'm quite glad they...
Yeah.
They brought it to a head. It's really important that Jewish people should not feel unsafe, in the same way that you shouldn't feel unsafe walking down your own street in your own postcode because there might be kids with knives. You know, you cannot risk removing this sense of safety, not in the name of often quite sort of airy-fairy things like the hate crime bill.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester then. Of course, you can read them in The Times every week with your Times subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next is the exit interview of Government Minister Mike Freer.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
The Big Thing.
We've already said.
Michael Whitney Freer is leaving us soon. Born in 1960, he's been the Conservative MP for Finchley and Golders Green since 2010. He served as a government whip and minister. One of more than 100 MPs quitting at the next election. In his exit interview, he tells me why he's standing down after facing several violent threats and attacks.
I remember my husband, D'Angelo, being very, very unhappy seeing me going to work at a stamp vest.
How the late Queen liked to gossip with government whips.
Tell me about so-and-so. I gather she's a bit of a handful.
And delivers his verdict on his former bosses, including Theresa May.
She was just kind of a machine.
Boris Johnson.
So next minute, I'm kind of doing his tie-up and putting his collar down and realised, oh, I've just touched up with PM.
And Rishi Sunak.
If you're going to go into bat against the Prime Minister, against Rishi, you really need to know your stuff.
So, Mike Freer, thank you for joining me for your exit interview. A chance for us both to learn what you could have done better. First question then, why are you leaving?
Broadly, for me, it's about personal security. And over the years, I've had numerous run-ins with various groups who threatened my life. That's alongside the routine abuse and every MP gets. We kind of take that on the chin. But a couple of run-ins with people who wanted to come and stab me. Then Ali Habibi Ali, who went on to kill David Amos, came to Finchley first. And luckily, by the skin of my teeth, I wasn't there that day. And he said he came to Finchley to harm me. And that could have been, well, that could have been fatal. And then the arson attack at Christmas, although that turns out to have been just a local scrote, as I say, who came to decided to have fun and set fire to the back of the office. You know, my husband and family said, I don't really care what the motivation is. If you're dead, you're dead. And so having to worry about my family worrying, you know, it's not really enough to carry on, and I should go off and do something else.
It's interesting because we've been doing this series for months now, speaking, I think it's 20 MPs so far, different parties. And when I ask that question normally, why are you leaving us? They say, well, I feel I've done my bit, or I've been here for so many years, or I want to do something else. There's a bit in the background possibly about they've got a very small majority. And then during the course of the conversation, actually, the abuse, the threats start sort of bubbling up in the conversation, and it actually seems to be playing on the minds of people more. You seem to be unusual in being so explicit about it, rather than being unusual that you've been targeted.
Yeah, I mean, we deal with the low-level stuff. I mean, as well as the kind of the big incidents with Muslims, Games Crusade, who targeted me twice, Ali Habibi Ali, and the art attack, they're the kind of the big incidents. But alongside that, you know, you come out of your house and you find a note on your car, and people know where I live, but not necessarily the car I drive. And that's always a bit of a worry. You know, I was followed around Brent Cross once by someone shouting, you know, you're useless, you're useless, you're useless. In itself, you know, not necessarily a physical threat, but still, you know, you should be able to go out and do your daily life without feeling that you're going to get abused. And that kind of stuff just eventually just grinds you down. And then after the Ali Habibi Ali incident, my office, my house became a fortress, panic buttons everywhere. on public events where people knew where I'd be. So if I was doing what's called a supermarket surgery, literally where you stand by the front door of the supermarket and talk to your constituents, you know, wearing a stab vest. And I remember very much my husband Angelo being very, very unhappy seeing me going to work in a stab vest. So that is a bit more, if like, in your face than perhaps other colleagues have had to have. But like every job, you have bad days. The inbox some days can be pretty fruity, shall we say, and other days you actually cut through and you can change things with people. So it's an amazing job, and I'm sad to be leaving. But I do have to, you can't, no MP can do this job without a supportive family. And if you're going home to a husband, a spouse who is worried about you, or you're leaving home to go to work knowing that they're worried about whether you're going to come home or not, then you have to think it's not really worth it anymore.
Do you think you get it worse than some? And do you know, do you have any sense of why that might be?
I certainly seem to have had more run-ins with violence than most. And certainly the run-ins against Muslims, against Crusades, was clearly driven by my support for Israel and the Jewish community. Ali Habibi Ali's motive was a bit unknown. I mean, he described himself as a soldier of Islam. That's about as close as a motive as we can get, because someone like David Amos and I, we were very different wings of the party. We had very similar views on Iran. We had very similar views on Israel and the Middle East. But beyond that, we didn't really have a lot of commonality. So that seems to be the only common trait. Obviously, some of the abuse tends to be a little bit anti-Semitic. Bizarrely, I'm not Jewish, but because I represent the seat with the largest Jewish community, people assume I'm Jewish. So sometimes you do get that level of abuse as well. But to be fair, a lot of MPs get abuse, and I have to say my female colleagues get it worse. So I've had perhaps more violent attacks, but the threats of violence tend to be much more directed at female MPs. What I found, Matt, was quite striking is after I made my announcement, four Labour MPs and one Conservative MP spoke to me privately and said that the four Labour MPs said they'd had someone in prison for death threats against them. And my Conservative colleague had someone who gone to prison for stalking. And I'm going, why didn't I know that? And I went to see the Speaker and I said, look, you know what's going on, because even the low-level stuff gets reported to the parliamentary security team. We need to publish in full what's going on so people can see the scale of it. Robust debate is one thing. It's, you know, our accessibility is a very special part of our democracy. But there comes a point where we have to kind of rebalance the debate about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. But at the moment, people don't know the scale of the problem.
Is there a broader societal problem? And I wonder about whether actually the tenor of our politics over the last 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years played a part in this as well, about the way politicians treat each other, the way politicians use the media to attack each other, the way the media treat politicians. I'm not trying to draw a line between, you know, the rhetoric, outspoken rhetoric from politicians to then someone seeking to attack, but is there a connection? Do we need to try to push the reset button?
I think there's a couple of things there, Matt, to unpick. I think if you go back and look at, sort of say, you look at the interviews between Mrs. Thatcher and Robin Day or Brian Wald, I'm sure my age now, but I kind of want to be a political junkie as a teenager. They weren't deferential. Well, they were kind of respectful, but not deferential. So, you know, she really got grilled, but it wasn't aggressive, talking over, interrupting, trying to make the politician out to be kind of some form of duplicitous crook. And I think that's the kind of bit that's changed. There is an erosion of trust in our politicians. And to be fair, I think there's an element of the way the media interview has changed. Interestingly, without naming the outlet, when I made my announcement, as you know, the media went absolutely wild. I was being asked for interviews right, left and centre. And there was one media outlet who just wouldn't leave me alone. I said, look, I simply can't do it today. I'm absolutely back to back. I do have a day job as well. And said, well, you don't really want us to chase you down the street with cameras, do you? And I felt like saying, so you want to do a story about intimidating MPs by intimidating an MP?
Wow.
That's a nice little story. But I think more broadly what's changed is the God, I'm really sounding like an old fart now. The old days, you know, if you wanted to write, you know, the people who used to write in grid ink, as they say, it was a bit of an effort to write an abusive letter to your member of parliament. Now you can tweet instantly. Now you can send an email instantly. And that lack of personal engagement, you're anonymous. So I think we've dehumanized in some ways politics. So things have changed. I think we can reset the dial, but it's going to be an uphill battle.
Let's move away from that, because clearly you've been in Parliament since 2010. We don't just want to talk about the manner of your leaving. You mentioned Margaret Thatcher. She was the MP in your seat. So what's it like being a Conservative MP in the seat where, with the exception of possibly Churchill, you know, she still towers over and influences, you know, probably gets quoted by someone in politics on an almost daily basis. What's that like following in those famous footsteps?
Well, I think to be fair, if you speak to the MP that follows any former prime minister, it's always the former prime minister's seat. But I mean, obviously, Mrs. Thatcher, as you say, was kind of an iconic figure. And of course, in Finchley, she's remembered not just as the prime minister, but she was an amazing constituency MP. And I saw a different side of her. And obviously, like everybody else, you know, you shout at the TV when she came on and think, what the hell's going on now? But usually she was proved right. But I still knock on doors and find people who say, oh, you know, Mrs. Thatcher was on our doorstep, okay, decades ago. And it was quite bizarre that there's this towering figure of history, amazing prime minister, who would go door knocking like any other. In some ways, you know, Theresa May is a very similar mould. The anchor was the constituency, and she always said the constituency was where she found out the truth. And we always tell a slight joke that when she used to be prime minister, she'd hold her surgery still in Finchley. So every few weeks she'd be in Finchley doing her surgery, and Mrs. Bloggins were there talking about the dripping tap or the broken paving stones. And then she'd jump in the car going back to Downing Street. And as soon as she left, obviously we knew the police would phone ahead to number 10 saying she's on her way back. We get a phone call apparently from number 10 saying, what the hell have you told her this week? Because they knew that as soon as she walked in the door, she'd be firing off questions, wanting to know what's going on. And so the constituency was very much her bedrock. And interestingly, it is true. I see every email, and some MPs have them filtered. I have an amazing team who triage them and deal with the donkey work, if you like. But I still see every email. And because, okay, you have clicktivism, you suddenly get 50 emails all identically worded. But if you suddenly get any, you know, 5-6 emails about a problem in, you know, Highfield Avenue, you think, it's interesting, what's going on there? And at the weekend, you'll have a little drive round and find out what's going on. So the constituency, the inbox isn't always representative, clearly. But sometimes you'll spot something in the inbox and think, that's odd, what's going on there? And that allows you to keep in touch with really what's going on in the constituency. It's an amazing constituency, so diverse as well.
It's really interesting that, though, because, you know, obviously we were just talking about the negative sides of technology, but actually the fact that people now feel they can just drop you an email and how that starts to build a picture of what's going on in your constituency, you know, clearly plays a big part of your day as well. So we should talk about your job. So you're coming in 2010, clearly a huge, you know, big change in the political landscape. Conservatives form a coalition with the Lib Dems. Since then, you've been a whip, you've been an exports minister, you're now at the Ministry of Justice. Which bit of your time in Parliament have you enjoyed the most? Backbench, whip's office, junior minister, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a really tough question. I have to say, I love being a whip. It is they are the unsung heroes. But also, you really find out how Parliament works in the whip's office, really how it all works on behind the scenes. And when I was old-fashioned title controller of Her Majesty's Household, that's really, you know, you kind of lurk behind the Speaker's chair, kind of helping the Speaker manage the flow of business. That's fascinating.
Is that also the one when you get taken hostage in Buckingham Palace?
No, that's the Vice Chamberlain.
Oh, okay.
That's the Vice Chamberlain. So that's the right. So that's bizarre, actually, because that's the role who writes to the sovereign every day. I wasn't in the whip's office when the King took over, but I did meet the Queen when I was appointed. So you have to go in and get your wand of office. I mean, it's great old traditions. And it's all run like clockwork. And every day you'd see the Vice Chamberlain writing these letters. And she didn't want Hansard, she wanted the gossip. Because she can read Hansard for herself. So anyway, you go in, you do the handover of the wand, and that's all the kind of formality. And then there's this kind of few minutes of informal chit-chat. And they say, now, so tell me about so-and-so. I gather she's a bit of a handful. She up to the, and you think, my God, she does read these letters. And she does want to know the colour of what's going on in Parliament. And that was quite an amazing experience, being part of, technically part of the royal household. But then, you know, I look at the job, you know, in terms of exports. My background is sales. So being the chief salesman for UK PLC was great fun. I used to joke that Boris had turned me into a Brexiteer, because I used to come back from overseas markets saying, you're right, they want to buy British. One of the biggest barriers to exports is getting British companies out there doing it. So we need to do more to get them on a plane out into overseas markets. And then inequalities, I've worked on diversity, multi-faith all of my public life, long before I became an MP. And now injustice, well, I'm not a lawyer, and that does allow you to ask the daft questions. And you say, so why do you do that? And it's like, well, we've handed it since about 1648. So I was like, and so it's great fun because I kind of, not being a lawyer, you are able to kind of unpick things and say, well, do we really need to do that now? Just because it's been done since 1648 doesn't mean we need to keep doing it unless it's actually working. So that's been fascinating. So controller probably edges ahead, but all of the ministerial roles have got high spots of their own.
You talked about the equalities brief. You played, I think people would say, other people have said, when you won awards for it, a significant role when the gay marriage bill was going through Parliament. And there were these debates going on, and people didn't know that they were, you know, they were sitting next to a gay MP having these debates. I suppose the first question, looking back now, did you feel you weren't able to be out trying to get elected in 2010?
I wasn't in, okay. If you like. I wasn't in the closet. I was out. But when I became leader of Barnet Council, the front page on the Hendon Times was Barnet's first gay leader. So it was hardly a secret.
Okay.
But when I got elected, I didn't want to be the gay MP. Straight MPs don't go wandering around the tea room saying, hello, I'm so-and-so and I'm straight. So my view is I just happened to go home to a man. And I didn't. I want to almost like downplay that side because it shouldn't really be that relevant. So it was bizarre that I was sitting alongside people who didn't necessarily know I was gay, and why should they? And listening to these bizarre conversations about how it's going to undermine civilization and did it bring down the downfall of the government, etc. And you're kind of hello, and maybe that's not quite so true. And so it's quite interesting having some of the discussions with colleagues as well, and I think on the whole, the debate was quite respectful. There are one or two colleagues who are particularly foul, and you kind of expect that. But what's been really pleasing is how many colleagues who opposed equal marriage have now stood up and said they got it wrong. And that's been really, really pleasing because, of course, the world hasn't stopped spinning.
This is the exit interview of Conservative MP and Minister Mike Freer. Mike, let's turn our attention to some classic exit interview questions now. Summing up your bosses, your various bosses you've had over the years since you were elected in 2010, sum up David Cameron in a word for us.
Smooth.
Oh, that could be taken two ways, Mike.
Polished, then. How about polished?
Polish is slightly better. Yeah.
David is a absolutely amazing politician. I remember... I think it was Nicholas Soames at the time said, you know, David Cameron is an accomplished politician. He has an amazing ability to get out of a tight corner, but also has an amazing ability to get himself into one. And he's also very, you know, he's good with people. He can disagree with you forcefully without you feeling you've been beaten up. And I think that's a real skill.
That's David Cameron then. Theresa May in a word.
Honest. I loved working with Theresa because... I dealt with her when she was Home Secretary. Was probably the most effective cabinet ministers I'd ever dealt with. So as a backbencher, or you know, you'd go across to see her to press an issue on a constituency issue. You'd go in. She was briefed. She knew what she was talking about. You have your asks, and she'd say yes or no. You knew exactly where you stood, and also if there was an agreed follow up, by the time you got back to your office in the Commons, her office had been on the phone setting up the follow-ups. Now, that was rare. Normally, when you meet a cabinet minister who promises to do something, you normally have to nag them for months on end. She was just kind of a machine. And I just found her incredibly efficient and also incredibly straightforward.
Very good. Boris Johnson, then, in a word.
Fun.
Bit like smooth, that can be taken two ways, Mike.
Well, I knew Boris from City Hall days, so I was never surprised at Boris's idiosyncrasies. You know, why anybody should have been surprised that Boris was slightly chaotic, slightly going off on a tangent at times. That was Boris's intellect. I mean, he's great fun to work with because he's intellectually challenged and he made politics fun. But you know, people always said that Boris didn't do detail. That was wrong because I saw firsthand he soaked up detail. I had to be quite careful because sometimes you weren't always quite sure the right detail came out at the right time. but he was phenomenally good to work with. And I always kind of joke that I've touched him up on at least two occasions. So, as you know, Boris was not always the smartest of individuals. And so when I was a Foreign Office whip, he was saying he was going off to have lunch with some visiting world leader. And I said, well, for heaven's sake, put your tie up, tuck your shirt in. So I had to kind of smarten him up a bit. And then I remember when he was Prime Minister, and this is when I was controller, I was lurking behind the Speaker's chair because the job was to get the Prime Minister in good time for PMQs. And of course, he comes racing down the corridor, as always Boris can. Again, hair all over the place, tie over here, collar up. So next minute, I'm kind of doing his tie up and putting his collar down. And then off he goes into the front bench. Then realised, oh, I've just touched up the PM. So it was kind of, and the thing I loved about Boris is that you could really have a real policy disagreement with him and he wouldn't take it personally. You know, he'd take it on the chin and you wouldn't fall out about it.
And he thought that was just part of politics.
Yeah.
So then Boris Johnson then replaced by Liz Truss, who you backed to be Tory leader. So Liz Truss, in
that
other
words.
That
was quite straightforward because I'd worked, when I was Equalities Minister, Liz was the Cabinet Minister for Inequalities, and I found her very easy to deal with. So again, another person that I could go into, have a real ding-dong on policy about what we needed to do on whether we had nuances of differences of opinion, and you could have that kind of robust cut and thrust with Liz, and then she'd give you a decision. Because there's nothing worse than actually being left in limbo. And the thing about dealing with Liz on the Equalities, she was very straightforward, very direct. And I also was incredibly grateful that when Boris and I kind of fell out over conversion therapy, when he wanted to kind of dump the bill, Liz was remarkably strong at stepping back in and saying we needed to keep the bill. And for that, I thought that was refreshing. It would have been quite easy as someone clear with aspirations to taking the easy way out and just kind of rode in behind the Prime Minister. But she put her neck above the parapet and said he was wrong and went into bat. And for that, I thought that was something that I was grateful for.
Was she the right person to be Prime Minister?
Well, I think history will tell that story.
Will you read her book?
Once I've left Parliament, I'll have plenty more time to read lots of books. It'll be on the list. I'm not a great one for reading political biographies, I have to say. My reading list tends to be forensic murder mysteries.
Wow.
I like chewing gum for the mind. Because in this job, you spend your life reading kind of dry documents.
Yeah.
So when I'm on holiday, the last thing I want to do is read about my colleagues. And so I want to read about, you know, how you can murder people efficiently.
I have to say, I'm similar. Mine is sort of biographies of old comedians. For you, it's murders. For me, it's the two Ronnies, but it's a similar thing. Sum up Rishi Sunak in a word.
Again, easy to deal with, does detail, very analytical. In many ways, he's similar to Theresa and Mrs. Thatcher, does detail. And so if you're going to go into bats against the Prime Minister, against Rishi, you really need to know your stuff. And he would respect if you've done your homework. So from that point of view, he's very easy to deal with.
Very good. That's your bosses then. So some classic exit interview questions. Would you recommend this job to a friend or family member or somebody you cared about?
I've said recently no, and that's possibly because it was all quite raw. I would say they have to think very long about it and really make sure their families understand what's involved. It can be the most rewarding job. And then you have to balance that up with it is 24/7 these days, if you let it. And you do have to carve out, be quite strict about carving out some personal time. And whether you get serious levels of threats or where you get the lower level of abuse, people do have to bear that in mind and make sure that they know what they're signing up for. I think it'd be quite rare now that you get MPs who serve for 25, 30 years. I think the role has changed dramatically. And I think the pressures of the 24/7, the social media, the emails has changed the role beyond recognition of what it was, you know, 20 years ago. So I think you'll see much more 10-year, 15-year MPs. And that's not necessarily a bad thing because fresh blood is good. But I think, yes, it's a job worth doing, but you need to go into it with your eyes open.
Are you sad about the circumstances in which you're leaving?
Of course. I love my constituents. Even though, like every MP, we've got constituents who drive us to distraction, and we've all got our frequent flyers in the inbox, and that's part of the job. But equally, we see many people where we genuinely make a difference. And actually, what's been quite heartwarming is actually the level of warmth. You're never more popular sometimes than when you step down. that kind of level of warmth that I've been getting has been, yeah, it's made me quite sad. But maybe, as I say in the show business, you know, you leave and leave them wanting more.
Whenever I've spoken to MPs who've lost their seats, they always say, well, if all the people who are telling me they're sad about it now and voted for them, it would have made it would have all been fine. Final question then, Mike, what will you do next?
Well, I've got a mortgage to pay, so I still have to go and earn some money. I don't know yet. I mean, obviously, I've got some strong interests that I'd like to pursue. And so I've still got a few irons in the fire. But to be honest, at this moment, I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen. That's the scary bit.
It's a world of possibilities. Mike, really, I really appreciate your time today and for seeing us with our exit interview. That was Mike Freer, Conservative MP for Finchley and Golders Green since 2010. Justice Minister standing down at the next election. Mike, thanks for joining us for your exit interview.
Thank you. I don't want to see you go, but
darling, you better go now. And we'll have another exit interview next week. There's basically not enough time ahead of the election to get everyone in, but there's plenty of them, so they'll keep coming up. Another exit interview on the podcast next week. And if you missed it over the weekend, we released a bonus episode of the podcast. Tim Shipman in the Brexit interview, talking about his new book, No Way Out, chronicling some of the Brexit years. You can just find that wherever you're listening to this. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.